everybody. Welcome back to another episode of 372 Pages. We'll never get back. I am Connor Listoka, and this is the podcast where me and Mike read bad books together with you, the loyal listeners. Mike, how's it going?
It is going very well. I was trying to come up with an old-timey thing of how it's going.
Oh, but sure.
Old-timey words, although I have a lot of them, I am told, didn't immediately come to mind.
Bee's knees is how you're...
I'm doing swimmingly. I don't think people use that much anymore.
No, fortunately, yeah.
Everything is copacetic, although that weirdly got resurrected by kind of the hippie culture.
Too. Oh, I would never have thought that was anything but hippie culture.
Okay, yeah, no, I think it's old. I think it's old-timey and then was picked up by the hippie culture.
Wow, yeah. President Grover Cleveland, a big fan of saying copacetic.
Yeah.
Both terms.
Yeah, token up and saying copacetic.
Well, it's old-timey times here at 372 Pages because we're reading a book that I think repeatedly almost referred to by the wrong name. I keep calling it Edison Conquers the Martians.
Yes, sure.
But, you know, there's a famous movie out there by Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. So it's sort of fun to imagine Edison in that role, attacking those Martians with the, you know, couple kids by his side.
Edison, you are the laziest man on Mars. Yes.
But yeah, it's a 1898 book written and published serially in the newspaper by Garrett P. Service. And I think some of that serial nature really rears its head during this installment, because we've covered a bunch of serials at Riff Tracks, Batman, and what's the one we're doing now? Captain Marvel.
Captain Marvel, yeah.
And you sort of, some of the old tricks employed by some of those 1930s serials really, I think, are reflected in this one as well, where it takes a little while for things to actually happen, and there's false starts, and Service employs those quite to diminishing effect here.
And also, what did they call the little chapter breaks, which were meant to, you know, speed the reader's eyes along, I assume, leads to a couple of comical things where the chapter title is like, yeah, you don't really need to write the chapter now, but right. I'll read it,
when
I
it's
guess.
The next okay. sentence, sure.
Like, yes.
But a couple of readers, or a couple of listeners, wrote in with some details about the publication of this serial, which is extremely funny. We got emails from Jay and Margot. I guess their copies of the book, I think there's a couple different copies out there. Oh, another update as well. Let me touch on this first, because their copy is not the one that benefits the Free River Community Project.
Okay. All right. We certainly advise everyone to benefit the Free River Project, but I understand not everyone can.
I think theirs are the ones that are like illustrated. So I think if you look for this book, there's like the cheap one, and then there's a slightly more expensive one that's like contains original illustrations, which is a good thing to have. The ebook, which I think we're both reading from, fortunately does have those illustrations, which do add a lot to the proceedings because they're pretty incredible.
Oh, they do.
At times.
But, they do, but there's another one with alternate, right? The there's just different illustrations.
The ebook, I'm not sure. I think the original illustrations are the ones we have that like have the aliens that we've...
I know, but there's another one. Yes, there's another one with different illustrations.
Okay.
Depicting, I think, from what I, a quick scan, the same moments, but, you know, like Edison and Service, but with normal-sized hands and heads and stuff. So just a little weird, just a different take on it was all.
Nice.
You know, like a sketch artist in court, you know, just
right,
different take.
But anyway, so I had emailed the guy of the Free River Project asking if we could talk to him. And
right.
So he did write back. I think he was a little confused. I try to be pretty upfront about what we are. And he seemed to think that we were wanted to do like a TV interview with him. But it is based in Wales. And then he was very enthusiastic. He wanted to tell me about a project in called The Velvet Chapel, which is a recreation of Andy Warhol's Art Factory. He says they're collaborating with various artists and have partnered with a record company to produce artworks using material from Jim Morrison, David Bowie, Lou Reed, and more. We have a psychedelic Rolls Royce and plan to do a magical mystery tour. I'll send you pics of the car and the chapel we have converted. We are a bunch of artists who make art and music of all kinds. I also live in a 37-acre permaculture community, so we might have a lot of interesting material for your viewers. Then he forwarded some emails of the chapel, which looks pretty impressive. It looks like a cool brewery, I think, like something you find in Portland or something. And then a picture of the psychedelic Rolls Royce, which has been airbrushed, very psychedelic.
Sure.
It looks like it's probably diminished the value a bit. It looks like a Burning Man art car, kind of. And we can post those to Patreon or something. But then I wrote back and said, hey, this looks amazing. Like, yeah, we'd love to talk to you, but we're not a TV show. We're a podcast. You want to talk to us over Skype? And that was 9 days ago, and he has not replied.
The power of the podcast.
I think so. So, unfortunately, that might be the last we hear from Free River. But anyway, the point was that in the other edition of the book, it contains some back and forth between Thomas Edison letters and then Arthur Brisbane, publisher of the New York Journal, that I guess is where one of the outlets that was running services serial.
Sure.
And it sort of mirrors this communication we had between me and the Free River community guy, because Edison is pretty much out of the gate as being like, and I'm not in. I do not do this. I'm not participating in this project. Because it starts with him saying, Edison says, like, hey, the announcement is worded in such a way that it undoubtedly brings me in as a collaborator. And I told Mr. Service I particularly did not want my name brought into it, which is amazing. Just considering how much it makes it look like him and Service are, you know, buddies in this book. So that was to the publisher. And then Edison also writes one to Service. He says, I have written Brisbane explaining that I objected because the announcement and pictures implied collaboration. I am not literary with a 200 horsepower imagination like yourself, so don't want a reputation for things I cannot do. So it sounds like his main objection was that it was sort of, you're implying that I can do these things like create flying machines and go to Mars and disintegrate crows. And I don't want people to have an inflated view of me, not the terrible writing and glacial pace of the book.
Yeah, I can look. I can make a small tube on which you can set a funnel thing, and you can hear someone singing "Mammy" faintly and horribly in the background.
Right. Yeah, don't.
I can't make electric cars.
And then the publisher writes back and says, "Like apologies, Mr. Service called on you at my request. My original hope was that you might consent to collaborate in this story. Mr. Service said, however, that you were unwilling to do so, but that you're willing to figure in the story as the hero. If Mr. Service, the author, saw fit to use you in the right way, you have not been used otherwise, as you will see if you will read the story as it progresses. The title of the story distinctly gives you as the hero of it. And Mr. Service, as the author, I shall be greatly obliged if you will tell me in what way our announcement says you are a collaborator. The story is called Edison's Conquest of Mars, so as it might have been called Tesla's Conquest of Mars, or Emperor William's, or John L. Sullivan's. There's nothing in this title that connects you with the authorship. So they, one, I think it's funny that he immediately goes to be like, hey, like, you know, it could have just been called Tesla's. Hey, like, you want us to do that? Like dropping the name of an X or something. But it does appear to be saying that, like, collaboration is different than just putting you in the title and giving you, making you the main character, which if I was Edison, I'd be like, no, that's, you know, you're still using my name to sell this terrible story of yours.
Yeah, it reminds me of the flattery reminds me of once, I guess I won't say his name, but a director whose films we have done, let's just say.
Oh, boy, yeah, sure.
I met him one time and we're around a table and just, you know, having small talk. And suddenly he leans forward and he's like, I see you as the FBI agent in my next movie. It's like, stop that. Does that work? Does that really work? Where I'm supposed to go, really? Yeah. What was it I said? What would you like me to say again? Like, Nelson's Conquest of Mars, huh? Well, I like the sound of that. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, print it up and I'll take your word that it's going to be good. Well, it reminded me of, like, if someone had come to Comic-Con and just stood in line to get an autograph with you and taken a picture, which, you know, however many hundreds of people have done, and then you saw, like, them, that picture on their website being like, me and Mike, like, working on this movie together, like, I've been sending out packets to studios, where it does appear that that's what Service objected to. There was a picture of him, of Edison and Service, And he's like, the picture implies collaboration, man. Like, that's why I'm upset. Or like if, you know, you met a politician at an event or something, and then that picture was on you as you're running for Congress or something.
I will say, this is a little bit of talk out of school, but why not? Because we're on the subject. There was a couple I met years ago at some event, and for the years since then, they have been spreading the, I'm telling you, 100% false rumor that I was utterly hammered and hitting on all the women. And I happen to remember this event. It was notable. There was someone else there. I won't go into details.
Okay.
But I remember it very distinctly. Like, no, my family showed up, and I had to go to this store and return something. Like, I remember everything about it. We had to walk. My young children accompanied me after the event. But I traced it down online, and then I found out who these people were. And it's like, what? Why? What? Like, I was there, man. I saw it. It's very strange.
Wow, that's very strange.
To be slandered for years. It's just very odd.
I was going to say it's very strange that there's another event out there like that, because that's, I mean, how I would describe you at every VIP event we have.
Yes. For those who are listening who've been at the VIP events, you know how these things go.
Yeah, so I think that's sort of what Edison's very noted concerns were. I mean, you know, everything he fears seems to be exactly what they're doing. So, you know, they're pretty much using him to sell the papers. And it is funny that they're like, yeah, we could use, you know, Tesla or Emperor William or John L. Sullivan. It's like, yeah, like if I'm going to make my movie like Brad Pitt and Connor, you know, go to the moon, it's like, or I could use, you know, the guy who played Ernest in those movies. Like, yeah, like you could use John L. Sullivan, who no one's heard of, or you could use the most famous and revered guy in the world. Like, I think one of them might move more papers.
Oh, it is pretty funny, though, that, you know, we've seen that, we discussed the photos of Garrett P. Service. Right. Like knocking around Edison's Menlo Park office in there, like with his hands in his pockets, jingling his change, like, hey, man, what's going on? Hey, get in here close. Let's get a little photo here.
Yes, exactly.
Please don't touch that. What does this doohickey do? Like banging on the side of something. Anyway, yeah, I got a real, real good project for you there, Edison. Real good, real good. Like, please, I'm busy.
I specifically said no photos. Well, just one. Then it's the lead thing. Service and Edison to collaborate.
Yep.
But so that's, you know, it speaks to his decent sense, although he did seem to, like, I guess, eventually remit to the thing. Oh, there's the one more picture of a something from the New York Post or whatever. There's a picture of an advertisement that's big text, Edison's Conquest of Mars, a sequel to Fighters of Mars. And then it says, like, you know, a little like plot description. And then it says, written in collaboration with Edison by Garrett P. Service, the well-known astronomical author, begins in the Sunday Post. So,
wow.
I think it's probably just a do it and sort the details out later, because what's he going to do? Like, really go through the trouble of, you know, suing a newspaper?
Wow. That's amazing.
Of course it's a collaboration. We've got proof right here. But so that's the backstory. Very fascinating. Thank you for sharing that with us. I think we should probably just get back into it. We started at chapter 6 this time.
Indeed.
I think that the important detail, the one that I, as you know, as I read this one, I had to go back and look, is the body count and the number of people in their crew.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the last chapter ended with them. They had gone to the moon. They found moon jewels. And then they buried some of their guys. And I believe that it says there was two or three people dead. I don't know if they ever clarified that. But that is the body count so far. A meteor tore through their ship and killed some of them. And I then went back even further. They have, I think, on the total amount of people on this mission are around 2,000 men, because it's 20 per ship and there's about 100 ships that they launched. So just to keep those numbers in your head as the body count starts to ratchet up quickly.
And to put everybody up to speed, this is a sequel to War of the Worlds of a sort, right? It's not an authorized sequel.
It's the
nothing about this book, obviously, is authorized in any way. But Martians came to Earth, destroyed everything, caught a cold, flew back to Mars, And so they got hundreds of millions of thousands of millions of dollars yes. together. All the nations came together, gave Edison a blank check because he said he could make electric ships, and they climbed on the electric ships. And one of them had already been tested. The 99 others had not been tested, so they decided to stop at the moon, and that's where we ended. They were walking around the moon, discovering footsteps and stuff. So that's where we are, right?
Yes, and this will take us through halfway through the book. Let's just get ahead of it. They do not get to Mars by the end of this chapter, by the end of this section we're about to cover here, which is pretty stunning because, as you said, they are on the moon, seemingly on their way to conquering Mars. But that's there's some events that happen along the way that, you know, as a serial does, tends to draw the action out a bit.
I will get ahead of it and just say one of my favorite moments in any book that we have ever done. such an unforced error made me laugh so hard.
Perfect.
But let's get to it.
Let's get to it because it starts off. This is just a taste of sort of what the authorship of Garrett P. Service is like. I'm going to read you the second sentence in this chapter, if I can manage to get through it. The airships had been partitioned off so that a portion of the interior could be darkened in order to serve as a sleeping chamber wherein, according to the regulations prescribed by the commander of the squadron, each member of the expedition in his turn passed 8 out of every 24 hours, sleeping if he could, if not meditating, in a more or less dazed way upon the wonderful things that he was seeing and doing, things far more incredible than the creations of a dream. So that ends with very soon after he promises a thrilling story of an encounter, but we'll be the judge of that based on how you just described the sleeping quarters there.
Really propels the action forward there, doesn't it? That Stephen King, like, suddenly they hit a like womp 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 where he puts in words, you know, like sound effects and stuff. No, this is lots of commas, subjective. What do they call
it? M-dashes.
Lots of M dashes and commas and
run-ons,
sub phrases, and yes, and big run-on.
I think as we go through this chapter, there's lots of places where, you know, Service was an astronomer, right, or a reporter, and then an astronomer, or he had some weird background, but he very much wants to let you know that he has taken like an introductory physics class or something like that, because you do get like all of a sudden you'll be, you know, talking about Martians and stuff, and then there will be miles per second and Newtons and stuff like that that I remember from junior year in high school physics.
Oh, he very much wants everyone to know that. Like, if he unfortunately he did not work in a pie shop, but if he had written a cozy mystery and inserted himself right. into it,
yes, yeah,
we would have gotten very much details about how you laminate a crust and stuff like
how you want the butter to be like cold but not frozen, because that's how you work it in to make the crust extra flaky.
You can shave the butter if you want, or you could make a rough pastry too. I won't go into details, but here's 4 paragraphs.
Yeah, if you want your dog to really enjoy it, this is the best way to prepare the dough.
All right, so here it is. They have the adventure with the comet, and then it promises, like, okay, I'm on board with an adventure with a comet. Nothing followed. There's another subhead.
Yeah,
a thrilling story of an encounter that nearly ended the great expedition.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Are you going to get to it? Is there another subhead?
It's giving you Moby Dick or The Whale. Those are the two options for the subhead title.
All right, so thrilling story. All right. And so, as you say, here comes that thrilling language that only a Garrett P. Service can do. No periodical comet, as I knew, was at this time approaching the neighborhood of the sun, and no stranger of that kind had been detected from the observatories making its way sunward before we left the Earth. Stop! I'm too thrilled.
Woo. Fan me down like James Brown. I'm unable to go any further. This is...
Oh, yes.
And then it just says, you know, but there was a comet. So, yes. Yeah, that's, you can understand the thrills having not done the research beforehand, and then one shows up.
Which prompted me to, I couldn't get out of my mind as soon as I saw that word, especially when it was uppercase comet. And the comet song began going through my mind. I looked it up, like, is this just my grade school song? Do you know the comet song, Connor?
I don't think so.
Okay. It has an entire Wikipedia.
All right.
It is set to Colonel Bogey's March.
Well, sure, of course. I mean, you know, you can imagine Garrett P. Service getting down to that.
From the movie The Bridge Over the River Kwai. Over? On the River Kwai? Bridge okay. on the River Kwai.
As mentioned in We Didn't Start the Fire, sure.
Yes, and it is simply, and I was like, there has to be more to it than I remembered as a child, which is this. And I didn't, the movie was before my time and everything, but for some reason kids would do it. You probably know the tune, it's whistled, it's...
Oh, sure, yeah, Comet, yeah. For the cleanser,
Comet
right?
will make your teeth turn green, yeah. Comet.
It smells
it tastes
like
Listerine. Okay. Yes, Comet.
It makes
will
you
make
vomit.
You vomit. So buy some Comet
and vomit
today.
Yeah, okay. That's a somehow that came across.
So as I wanted to check you and see first of all if you knew it, and then it sounds like you knew the variation.
Okay.
Where a comet, it what is it? Tastes like Vaseline?
Or? Oh, gasoline is what I said. Yeah.
Okay, Vaseline or gasoline, and Wikipedia had all the variations. Well, I was like, okay, so that's a pretty crappy, you know, parody song. No reason for kids to know it many years after.
Sure.
So there has to be other more compelling verses. Nope, that's the entire song.
Wow.
It's like, come on, kids of the past. That is garbage.
Yeah, really. It doesn't even get updated every few decades like the Rod Stewart, Alanis Morissette type of thing.
Exactly. The Jingle Bells thing had Jingle Bells, Batman Smells had many variations.
Yeah, we just did a movie that had a creepy bald guy. So I was looking up the Addams Family Started When Uncle Fester Farted song. Right. And even that that's only like four lines and it had a couple different variations.
Yeah. So anyway, it's just the Comet song. If you have any other variations, please write in because I was astounded that such a shabby song could go through history. But there it is.
What was the name of the song that's the tune of?
Colonel Bogey's March, I believe.
So I'm sure that there's a video audio of Dennis Miller saying the name of that song, probably.
Of course.
Well, the comet, I guess, is passing by the ship, even though they didn't expect it to. And so that delves us into whether or not, like, it loops them along, like, by its gravitational pull, correct?
Yeah, they get
caught
attached
in
to the comet, yes, and they ping forward and back. So this is 100 ships. I didn't realize it was 100.
Yeah, it's a whole armada.
Being towed by this thing, and I have to say, because this is, you know, pretty much right off the bat, they get a couple of their guys die with an asteroid, then they get attached to a comet, and you know, you want to go like, hey, Edison, idiot, did this come into your calculations at all?
Edison's just at his computer looking at pictures of crows, like whoa, it clicks away, alt tabs away.
But, you know, I guess this is a generation enthralled by the cotton gin, so it is kind of hard to blame.
Sure.
They're flying in electric ships.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he's correct in that, you know, you assume there's going to be some trouble as you're trying to get there, but it does sort of stack up pretty quickly. I really enjoy if you, like, get, you know, a little into the comet attacking. He's like, there was a fair prospect of being dissipated in blazing vapors. The comet dragged us unwilling prisoners into the immediate neighborhood of the solar furnace. And then there's an illustration that's like a, you know, it's just a black and white thing. It looks like a block print or something. But there's two guys looking out the window of their spaceship, and there's a gigantic comet blazing by very close. And one of the guys is just pointing at the comet as if it's like, yeah, we saw it. We're very aware. It's definitely the guy who said moon jewels is the one who's doing it.
Yes.
You guys see that comet?
So they have no hope. They cannot escape. The comet, imaginary forms reveal themselves amid the flaming meteors. Mm-hmm. This is him looking at the comet. They're just like, we're dead, so let's just stare at this thing. It's so strange.
Yes.
And the comet seemed like creatures in agony, tossing their arms, bewailing in their attitudes, the awful fate that had overtaken them, fairly chilling my blood with a pantomime of torture which they exhibited. I thought of an old superstition, which I had often heard about the Earth, and exclaimed, "Yes, surely this is a flying hell." I'm like, hey, Garrett, go clean the latrines or something. We're trying to figure out how to unattach from these comets.
Right. Yeah. I imagined him saying, like, "Yes, surely this is a flying hell." And then sort of like looking around and nobody heard him. So he has to like walk into the next room and sort of say it a bit louder, just hoping that he can get a reaction from people. You guys remember that old superstition? No, you never. What is that? Like, what does he mean? What superstition is he talking about?
He's looking at the side of their faces, you know, like trying to not to catch their attention, but they're like tapping wildly at things like, what are you talking about? We're trying to.
I also like that he said he saw imaginary forms revealing themselves, like they seem like creatures in agony, and it says it chilled my blood. It's like, you just said they were imaginary. Like, old-timey guys love like imagining something and then chilling their bones with the thought of it.
Yes. You made it up. You're having a weird vision. Calm down.
Right. But he reveals that, you know, they're being towed along with it, like yo-yoing back and forth. And it says they were so absorbed with it that someone eventually in the flagship recalled to us a more accurate sense of our situation in space by exclaiming, "Why, there is the Earth!" So someone just noticed the Earth out there in the middle of space. And then I think this was Moon Jules again goes, "We are going to strike it," exclaimed somebody. "The comet is going to dash into the Earth." So at some point in time, you know, who was the name of the guy that he famously talked about, the guy who had written the calculus book that he was name dropping? He just name dropped every single like ruler and scientist in the world in the last section. And then in this section, he just does a bunch of "some guy yelled."
Some guy, yes, it was Sylvanus.
Sylvanus P. Thompson, I think. Yes. Yeah, so if that was the level of guys that you were trying to impress us with, you could just toss any given name in there. I think just attribute it to somebody.
Well, that brings us to our first sonic challenge.
Oh, very nice.
The very next sentence: they are about to be dashed into Earth by the comet that they did not ever see, nor did they expect, nor did they calculate for. Well, they made 100 electric ships, but he sees Earth, and so Edison cries, "Thank God this saves us." Then there is an unattributed sentence that begins, "What? M-what?" Question mark. And so that is for you. I'll play Edison, and you play the unnamed person. And that is your sonic challenge.
Okay, I'll give it my best.
"Thank God!" Is that that's my Edison accent?
Sure, he's
"Thank God,
Adam
this
Carolla.
Saves us."
Try to
this
guess.
Saves us.
What? What?
Is that your M? The M dash implies more space, doesn't it?
Okay, all right, yeah. Try it. Set me up again.
"Thank God, this saves us."
What? What?
Okay.
I think it's more of a you know, consternation at his proclamation there.
Yeah, I don't know. Is it Moon Jewel's guy? Just like what?
What? An idiot? Okay. What? Like yeah. What? What?
Wait. What? I don't know. It's open to interpretation. That's why it made me laugh. Why two whats?
Okay, I'm going to do it as if I was Sylvanus P. Thompson.
Okay, all right. "Oh, thank God, this saves us."
What? What?
God, you sound exactly like Sylvanus P. Thompson.
Thank you. That's my one-man show I'm working out.
It's awesome.
Taking it to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Nice.
And then after that, they are being pulled towards Earth by this comet, and we get a patented Garrett P. Service-ism here that he you would think that this would stop happening because it's so hacky, and we probably ought to have a count on them because I feel like by the end of this section, he's done this about 8 times. It says, "The Earth, which we were going to defend and protect, had herself turned protector. Reaching out her strong arm had snatched her foolish children from the destruction which they had invited. It would be impossible to describe the chagrin of every member of the expedition." So what has happened is that, like, the stronger gravitational pull of the Earth has, like, you know, has sent the comet off on, like, a different path and attracted them back to it. So it's like acted like a stronger magnet and saved them, I guess. But
it brought them back to the very New York neighborhood where they left. And then, speaking of hackiness, more comes. I shall not delay my narrative by undertaking to describe the astonishment and disappointment of the inhabitants of Earth when, within a fortnight from our departure, they saw us back again. And so this is where I laughed out loud, because it's amazing. Like, have you whipped them?
Yeah.
How many are lost? Is there any more danger? And then, Faye, have you got one of the men from Mars? What are you doing here, Seamus? Groundskeeper Willie, what?
Yeah, there's a couple different Irish or Scottish people that turn up through this. And I guess there was just, you know, I anticipated it being like in the Spider-Man movie where some guy's like, yeah, that'll teach you to mess with the Big Apple A type of guys. But it's, yeah.
Hey, I can start walking you again.
But yeah, it's just a pure, tis a shame they dealt you such a blow.
But I imagine that, how many did, like, how bad you give it to them? And then, so they're all defeated? And then all these guys standing around like, yeah. Oh, they are. Hey. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said, did you get trapped by a comet and come back here? I thought you said that, but you said, did you defeat the Martians?
Hey, I noticed you tugging on your collar and releasing a lot of steam. Hey, what's up with that?
I notice you're not looking me in the eyes. You're looking at your shoes and kicking stones on the ground. Hey.
What does Faye mean? F-A-I-X. Do you know what that is?
Well, I don't assume that means like faith or.
Yeah, I guess so.
Just an exclamation like
in British.
Dang.
Oh, yeah. It could be faith, but it could also be fex. F-E-C-K. That sounds like a bad word.
Feck. That's the Irish pronunciation.
Wow. Well, that'd be kind of a easy thing to slip into a newspaper.
Yes.
And then he moves right on. It says their rejoicings and facetiousness were turned into wailing when the truth was imparted. And then it does one of the subchapter headings, a short stay on the earth.
We could just get to grab a couple loaves of bread here.
Out of here. Start the car. It says we made a short stay of it, for we had not the heart to go into details. We told of our unfortunate comrades who we had buried on the moon. And there was one gleam of satisfaction when we exhibited the wonderful crystals we had collected. Any particular utterance from the New York guys? Hey, they got the moon jewels there.
Moon jewels,
let me show you the family jewels. Hey.
So the guys who gave them millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. You know, strike up the brass band, and the guys in top hats come up to them as they're standing there. All right, keep it out. Guys, how did it go, man? We are just going to grab some stuff, and we will be... So it was... quiet down. Let's hear what they have to say.
You conquered all of Mars, and you only lost two or three men and one ship. This is so much more incredible. We thought there'd be, you know, two of you coming back. Ah.
Oh, they're getting in the ships again. They're taking off. What in the... What is going on?
Yeah, and it says within 24 hours, we were ready for our second start. So they really did you want to even just say hello to your families or anything like that? No, we got to stay acclimated. Our cabins are pressurized and we can't even take off these spacesuits. So you're unable to identify us. So no need to tell anybody who the shameful speeches were made by.
Oh, but why from a writing aspect? This is what made me laugh about it, is just this whole having to write your way out of this. Why not just make it a different planet?
Sure.
Or something else, and then, you know, we were saved by this giant, you know, asteroid or whatever, and we sat down there. Like, why make it going back to Earth, having a false start, starting all over again, having the people go like, all right, we whipped them. And then,
it
just seems like such a writing unforced error.
Well, yeah, I just wrote it down. I said, like, if a movie did this, imagine how livid we would be if just you did your whole, 40 minutes and then fall started back to just sort of doing it again, which I'm sure we've done something exactly like that. But I thought it was just pure, newspaper serial, Batman serial time padding.
Sure. But, just filler.
But you're correct. We were caught in the comet's tail. The speed that it was moving was so much faster than anything our engines were capable of that it whisked us to another solar system in a matter of days, where we then landed on another planet, blah, 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 that had beautiful women who looked like just like Earthlings, but with like slightly greenish tinted skin, lots of banging, et cetera. Now we go back to Mars type of thing. But
lots of etc. That would be your story. Okay.
Yeah, that would be my chapter heading in bold. But I feel like he, as we go on, and the Moon Jewels were an example of this, his imagination is extremely limited by just what he's seen on Earth. They went to the moon and they discovered diamonds.
Yes.
They get caught in a comet. Course. They go back to Earth. So it's really, there's another very good example of that coming up later. But it really is just like, I was reading this book with my niece who's 4. And, it was like, what noise does these things make? And I was like saying like, oh, like, she's like, who says moo? And I would say like, the Tyrannosaurus Rex. And then, when it was her turn, she would obviously just like look around the room and see something and just be like, oh, the TV. And, but that's what he's doing. He'd just be like, oh, they go to the moon and find diamonds. Like there's just a lack of imagination.
Yeah. He's the things he already knows that are very, very familiar with just a slight little difference to it.
And I think that's how some of those like 1950s space movies we worked to, you just go up there, find diamonds and be excited about that, as opposed to, finding an incredibly rare, mineral that like you can perpetually power all of Earth with just like with a gram of it type of thing. Like, which, that took 5 seconds off the top of my head to think up, but,
right.
This will revolutionize energy. We'll power all of the world. But, nope, just the precious metals we already know exist and have a decent amount of here on Earth already.
Yep. Comet pulled us off to the very neighborhood we took off from.
Yeah, even like landing in the middle of a place that was a less developed part of the world where they might be amazed to see these spaceships coming down would be kind of fun. But
wow, could have been a great opportunity for old-timey racism.
Yes, like, come on, man, service. Gosh. Come on. it says, the needed computations of velocity and direction to flight having been repeated, the ships being in all readiness, we started direct for Mars.
Again.
Well, because it says something like this: the moon was no longer in a position to help us on our way. It had moved out of the line between Mars and the Earth. Did they need the moon? I thought they just went there to bury their dead.
I thought they went there to, that was like the trial run for the other ships. Like,
oh,
we gotta, we gotta kick the, we gotta blow the carbon out of the cylinders of these babies,
right?
By going to the moon, and then we'll just, as long as we're there, we'll park it. There's an open spot, so let's park there.
Yeah, because some things do that, the Hubble telescopes. You slingshot them using the gravitational pull of Jupiter or something. But I don't think that's what he was. I think he just sort of made an error.
Yes, who knows how long apart he was writing these?
Yeah,
I think famously Sherlock Holmes would describe how Watson had taken a Punjab bullet in India. And the location of the bullet would change.
Oh, like, wow.
I think there's 3 locations of where he got shot, because he's just like, I don't remember it. I'm not going to look back at my notes. So that's what service is doing here.
Nice. He gets into some of his science talk when he starts talking about like how long they have to go. But it he says it might reasonably be expected to do so. We should arrive at Mars in a little less than 42 days. So he's got a lot of more time to pad here. Like this false start, I guess it didn't really cost him much time at all.
No. And here's another thing where some things he elaborates on where I don't need the elaboration. Here's one I wanted so much more elaboration. Nothing occurred for many days to interrupt our journey. We became accustomed to our strange surroundings, and many entertainments were provided to while away the time.
Yeah. Yep.
What were those entertainments, Garrett P. Service?
How dare you, sir?
How dare you omit them?
Because, yeah, all they did was bring along scientists and, you know, some military guys and stuff. But so, I, you know, all right, well, turns out that Sylvanus B. Thompson can do a little ham bone. So that'll be tonight's entertainment, half an hour of ham bone.
We're very much like the Navy here. So Garrett P. Service will be wearing a coconut bra and a mop for a wig, and we will see a little burlesque tonight. Yeah. So that's one of the many entertainments we have here.
We've got a astrophysicist who is considered by pretty much everybody in his lab to be the funny one. So he'll be doing a little bit of stand-up for us here tonight.
His tight five. So I see Kelvin's in the audience. That certainly makes my temperature rise. All right, all right, all right, all right. What else can I tell
you about? Not many laughs talk about absolute zero. Whew.
Oh, don't date much. Big surprise. Oh. Got anyway, the... I think... oh, it looks like the stew is done. All right. So let's eat.
Yeah, I was very disappointed to miss that as well. But I also thought that Ernest Cline might take a little pleasure in the fact that it took 42 days to get there. That being the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy number, he would drop that and get a knowing. His participants would exchange a knowing wink with each other.
Yes. So they come near to Mars.
I thought so as well. That's clarified
that's what
later.
I thought. Yeah. I had notes about that, and then later. But it says drawing near to Mars.
Okay. Oh yeah, it does. It does. That's a bold chapter subtitle.
Yeah. So they could discern features and everything, and Martians and everything. But it's an asteroid.
Got it. Yes, it is.
So did they think it was Mars? I didn't. That's where I was a little confused. Like, are they looking at Mars, and all of a sudden they look out their left mirror in their light or in their window, and they're like, ah, we're passing by an asteroid. I don't know how I missed that.
It says, you know, among the stars which shone in the quarter of the heavens where Mars appeared as the master orb, there was one lying directly in our path. It's a little planet. I thought it might be a moon or something. But then it says, bold chapter heading, the asteroid. Next sentence, it is an asteroid, said somebody.
Said somebody. Oh, this is great.
Moon Jules guy.
Here's the Moon Jules guy. He comes up here. Several asteroids, said one of the astronauts, which travel inside the orbit of Mars, blah, 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 a bunch about asteroids. And then another unnamed person, this must be one of them. And then Moon Jules guy, manifestly so.
Nice. Glomming on. Waiting till the asteroid has been identified at least twice as an asteroid before he also throws in and agrees with everybody.
I guess manifestly so is the version of... remember when Terry Silver announced that he was going to build karate studios all over the valley?
I might even operate them for free!
And a guy goes, woo! He was very excited about possibly opening free.
I had to look this up recently because there was something we were doing that was Terry Silver-esque. And when he's going to operate it for free, he prefaces that by saying, I've always said, the more you give, the more you get.
Okay,
so that's
where the woo is.
That was what some guy really, he just agreed with the sentiment.
That's manifestly so. That's what this guy is doing. It's it's the woo of an 1898.
Yes, I think it's an old-timey woo.
Yes.
And then they start approaching this thing. I think it also might draw them in with gravitational pull, but then we get another back-to-back subchapter heading, a Martian appears, exclamation mark, the first glimpse of the horrible inhabitants of the red planet. And we get one more. The name dropping is pretty much ceased by this point in time, except for Lord Kelvin, who keeps making an appearance. But it says, there are inhabitants upon it, but what giants? What monsters? Don't you see? Exclaimed an excited savant. They are the Martians. That got my first settle down in this entire chapter. I don't know what old-timey thing that's even referring to, but I guess that's meant to imply that that guy was the first to figure it out.
So, yeah, this is, by the way, a drawing that you simply have to see.
Yes, we got to post that when we post it in case anyone doesn't have access to these.
Stockings, knee pads, a little shaped dress.
an actual dress, yes.
Tucked at the waist.
Mm-hmm. And a fanny pack off to the side.
Fanny pack. A chainmail collar, it looks like.
Connected to a hood, and then there's some steampunk goggles with a little World War I German guy spike on the top of it.
And then clearly has some sort of thyroid issue or something. The eyes are bulging. There's some sort of sack at the back of the head, which I don't know what that is is never mentioned.
Well, it might be we might be measuring that later with our phrenologists.
Oh, right, of course.
Yeah, it's very. It strikes me as an illustration you'd see in an old Alice in Wonderland book, one of those type of characters. It's just the dress and that thing, or a guy who would a traveling troupe of minstrels that would come to entertain a king somewhere.
Yeah, the pointy stockings are kind of the big. That was the most surprising thing about these super intelligent. They go many times. He stops to talk about how intelligent these creatures are. So utterly intelligent, they wear pointy stockings. It just doesn't mesh with what I thought.
Foot comfort.
Yeah, so they discover these giant, hideous Martians.
Monstrous enemies.
Terrible to behold. camel caps on that. Yeah, that fanny pack is terrible to behold.
Really, yeah, just, even when they were in fashion, they were never really in fashion,
Yeah, remember the first time a friend of ours, a dear friend, came to me and another friend, and she had just purchased Crocs and was very happy about them and was really, really disgusted with our response to them. As we and the friend knew her well enough to go, dear God, those are the most hideous things I've ever seen. And she said, these are going to be big. And she was, of course, absolutely right.
Wow.
And was right to be wearing Crocs. But that was the first time I had ever seen them.
Yeah.
And I blanched and nearly vomited. And she was very upset by that.
Yeah, it's a hard road to be a fashion trendsetter. It's not something that I'm willing to undertake just because.
I will give you $100 if you dress up like this Martian.
Oh, wow.
Take a photo.
Oh, man. We might have some steampunk sort of goggles from an old Halloween costume.
But I think the hardest part is going to be that weird little fitted dress that kind of shows your thighs off but then drapes around your bottom. That's going to be tough.
Yeah, because it has a very revealing. I mean, it almost looks like a Darth Vader helmet in terms of the cutout in the very front.
It is. It is accentuating for sure that area down there. Yes. Yeah.
Well, maybe if anyone does dress up like this, I've still got my copy of Gump and Co. on my desk. Maybe that could be a prize for anyone who replicates this costume. if you were reading the copy without the illustrations, which I guess in this day and age you wouldn't have because the newspaper would be printing them, you wouldn't get a sense that they look like that at all until he later on goes to describe them. As wearing a dress, but they surmise that these people have fallen afoul of this asteroid and run upon this rock in the ocean of space and been wrecked like castaway sailors upon a block of ice. So they're sort of like, guys in a Far Side cartoon on a desert island with one palm tree in it. These guys, they just have surmised that they've been abandoned here.
Yeah, this is what I didn't understand. So these people, the most logical thing is, these Martians flew to Earth, attacked it, laid utter waste to all of the globe, caught a cold, flew back, regrouped, started off and crashed 100 yards from their planet and stayed there. That's what they think is the most likely thing.
Right, yeah, until they get down there. They discover the reason they're there, but yeah, I think they're just like, these bums had, couldn't figure out how to steer around this planet.
Yeah, and so much was their confidence that an electric steersman yelled, "We've got them then." And so they're all like, "Woohoo! We thought it was going to be a challenge. This is just going to be mop up."
Right. Yeah, we've encountered nothing but failure so far, but we remain confident.
Yes. So they do. They take after the malevolent creatures.
Oh, man.
And that is when little surprise comes their way. This is revealed in a heading, "The Awful Heat Ray." So, if you're wondering what's coming, I think he's given away the ghost here.
Sure. Yeah. It's also followed then by another ship destroyed.
So this is a mile-long, dazzling lightning stroke that, like, withers the car and destroys an entire electric car or electric ship.
Yeah, electric car, the space ship of space they once called it.
Ship of space.
Yeah, it licks it with lambent flames, collapsing it into a mere cinder.
Oh, those lambent flames are the ones that really get you. Dang.
And it says, for an instant, not a word was spoken. So sudden and unexpected was the blow. And, you know, unexpected is a weird way to put it, considering what they just did to the Earth. But I guess your electric steersman just instilled everyone else with confidence when he said, now we've got him.
And at that point, as they were melting, because there's also another drawing there of the a ship just being melted by this mile-long lambent ray. No one says, like, Edison, what is this? You know, like, did you calculate for this? Like, you know, it's a heat ray. I could have made one, didn't want to. Yes. You know. So
yeah, can it denude a crow? Yeah,
yeah.
How about that?
After you know, switch the setting for crow denuding. Yes. On the front of it. Look it up in the little, I have a little book that you have to hang over with a hook on your belt to look up all the...
Yeah, it's like a copy protection from an old computer game or something. Like, turn this dial to a crow. Set this one to the gravity of the planet you're on. And while they're doing that, a second flaming tongue of death shot out, destroying another of our ships with all of the crew. So... if you're doing 20 men per ship, that's 40 men who just went down. So the body count is currently around 43 guys, and they've lost 3 ships, I think.
Yeah, so all the guys are killed. Heat ray, lambent flames licking at their ships and melting them. However, it would not do to despond. We had been incautious, and we should take good care not to commit the same fault again. All the dead guys are like, you could be a little despondent.
Yeah. Or, you know,
spend a second or no. Okay.
That's right. After he describes it as an inauspicious beginning for us.
their corpses are still like the powder of their charred corpses is still floating around in space.
Yeah. My, I'm quite consternationed here. It's
oh, yes.
Yeah. Inauspicious is like, you know, your starting pitcher walks the first two guys. It's like, well, this is an inauspicious start to this game. Like,
A lot of consternation from our chief in our dugout there.
But he did describe the Martians a little while back. He said, in our eyes, their moral character shone through their physical aspect and thus rendered them more terrible than they otherwise have been. Which is, you know, it's a lot to judge someone by the way they look. I guess they have, you know, waged war on Earth already. But it's a big, that's sort of your old-timey racism right there, I guess. Just looking at someone and being like, ah, yes, I could tell by their bulging back of their craniums that their moral character is low.
Yes, and you know, they're a mile away, so right, that's through a telescope. Like, I don't like the looks of that fella. Yeah.
Look at the hip that fanny pack is on, jutting out like that.
Oh, that's the end, I think.
That's the end of chapter six. Yeah, it says the first thing to do was avenge the death of our comrades.
So a lot happened. So chapter seven?
Yeah, chapter seven. It says, speaking of Edison's like failure to deliver on something that could deliver flaming tongues of death, it says, we did not even know the limit of the effective range of our own disintegrators. Like, you know, Wizard of Menlo Park here, you didn't want to, couldn't try that out on a mile away, crow, while you were doing all this stuff?
Yeah, back up from that wall a few steps. Does it go that far? I don't know. We'll find out when we're up there.
And then he goes on to describe it thusly. If it should prove that the Martians were able to deal their strokes at a distance greater than we could reach, then they would, of course, have an insuperable advantage. On the other hand, if it should turn out that our range was greater than theirs, the advantage would be on our side. Or, what was perhaps most probable, there might be practically no difference in the effective range of the engines. Thank you for walking us through those three outcomes that are possible, sir. Those do seem to cover every possible outcome that is there.
That is, gets the same groan from me that my dad and other dads used to do when you know, a game is on or something, and you're like, what's the score? 14-7. Who's winning? 14.
Oh, like, God.
Go to hell.
Dads across the world devastated when they introduced the permanent score bugs on the screen in like the dawn of HDTV.
Why perhaps the most probable?
Yeah.
Like, I just say I am 100% pulling this out of my ass mm-hmm. now. We have no idea, but most probably, you wonder why, you know, people lose faith in like doctors and stuff when they just like with 100% certainty, well, of course this is going to work. Like, yeah, that just that killed my brother. Like, well, I mean.
Yeah. So sure, there's going to be some rounding errors that your brother unfortunately fell into when you're talking about thousands of millions of people.
So they do shoot back.
Yeah.
against the ray, the lambent heat ray. Mm-hmm. What does lambent mean again?
I couldn't tell you. I just said it. It is an old-timey. Yeah.
Sorry. The stroke that we had dealt was taken by several of the electrical ships as a signal for a common assault, and we saw two of the Martians fall beside the ruin of their engine, their heads having been blown from their bodies. And I immediately was like, wait, I thought when you disintegrated something, all that was left was a disagreeable smell that you all chuckled politely at.
Right. Yeah. Unless they've like set it to, just the head concentration or whatever. Like he specifically said, like every, it left behind their armor.
Yeah. And I think all they did was heat ray, the lambent heat ray had a, like a ball at the end of it where they saw the ray come from, like a lightning rod kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. It's a polished knob, please.
I'm sorry.
We're going to get a lot of knob talk as we go on into the section.
Speaking of polished knob, that that Martian's a little dress thing is certainly going to display that at some point.
That would be great if that was the only detail he provided about this physique. Their genitals, of course, were in the back, unconventionally, so they were able to have that dress that exposed the front.
Imagination cannot even explain the genitals on these creatures. However, six paragraphs of this should suffice.
I'm not sure how that happened, but two of them had their heads blown off, and then other ones, two of them stretched headless upon the ground. Three others had suffered horrible injuries where the invisible vibratory beams from the disintegrators had grazed them, and they could not long survive. And only one remains apparently uninjured. So it's like, the adagio for strings is playing as he's the mm-hmm. one survivor's looking around in slow motion and his friends are, bleeding out and, smoke emerging from their headless necks.
Yeah, the sound kind of goes out like Saving Private Ryan and, slow motion and the camera jitters a little bit. And then Garrett P. gives us this. But let the reader not suppose from this inadequate description that the Martian stirred in the beholder precisely the sensation that would be caused by the sight of a gorilla or other repulsive inhabitant of one of our terrestrial jungles suddenly confronting him in the native wilds.
Wow.
You know, gorillas just sitting there being gorillas getting sideswiped by Garrett P.
Yeah, really. Coco is signing languages like, what did I do to hurt you, Garrett P. Service?
Little tear going down his cheek.
This kitten strikes Coco and says, like, I still love you.
I'm repulsive? signing to her. No.
That's the paragraph after he says, it is impossible for me to describe the appearance of this creature in terms that would be readily understood. Was he like a man? Yes and no. It's just, quite the hack job here, like, in terms of, because it's not like he's, like, saving us these descriptions because he's so committed, as you said, like, to moving the plot along like Stephen King. They've already gone back to Earth, so he's not, like, worried about wasting words. He's just unable to do it. So I wonder if he, like, advised the artist about it, these illustrations, or if that was just sort of like, it looks good to me.
Yeah, I don't know, but he says he can't describe it, but then he does describe it here. And I thought this particular sentence would be funny to do to, one of the beef eaters at the British Royal Guards who can't respond.
Okay. Go up to
the sensations of one who had stood face to face with Satan when he was driven from the battlements of heaven by the swords of his fellow archangels and had beheld him transformed from Lucifer, the son of morning, into the prince of night and hell, might not have been unlike those which we now experience as we gazed upon this dreadful personage. Martian's like, all right, settle down, so, man.
Come on. Like, and then you hold up the picture of that to the Beefeater, and that would probably what would cause him to laugh. Like, that? Yeah, and that's just them, like, looking at them. I mean, I guess, you know, you're slightly colored. Like, if I told you that, if I was like, hey, I'm gonna introduce you to my coworker. He's a real jerk. He reminds me of Lucifer, the son of the morning, when he was transformed into the prince of night and hell. That might color your perception of if you noticed him, like, taking the last shrimp puff off a table at a catered event. You'd be like, yeah, he really does seem like kind of a dick. But so it's probably colored a bit by them having wiped out a lot of the earth, but it does seem a little over the top.
Yes. And they want to kill this horrible, you know, Satan himself. Mm-hmm. But everyone's like, kill him, you know, destroy him right now. And Edison says no. And here, what is he? Oh, okay. He says, this was something entirely new to nearly all the members of the expedition. Mr. Edison, however, had confided to me before we left the Earth the fact that he had invented a little instrument by means of which a bubble, strongly charged with a powerful anesthetic agent, could be driven to a considerable distance into a face of an enemy where exploding without other damage, it would instantly put him to sleep. Did anyone go like, huh? I was poring over the budget proposals you sent us when we gave you thousands of millions of dollars. That was not one of the line items. What's going on here?
Because under office supplies, that covers a lot of things.
Oh, bubbles that explode in the face of enemies is like a stapler. Got it.
I also just enjoy the fact that, you know, he keeps pulling Service aside to tell him these things, and Service reveals that after the fact. Hey, Service, just between you and me and the lamppost, I've invented a powerful anesthetic bubble that can be driven a considerable distance into the face of an enemy. All right. Have a good day. Enjoy lunch. Yeah. I also enjoyed that when Edison says, I shall not kill him, we have another use for him. Tom, bring me the anesthetizer. He just has an assistant who had brought from his laboratory that named Tom, who I'm guessing never shows up again, but he's tasked with anesthetizer retrieval.
So, is that the someone? Maybe that was Tom who said, kill him, said someone. He is too horrible to live. Tom, you know we have a bubble that we can explode.
Right. Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. You know what? You know, because of the outburst, you retrieve it, Tom. That'll teach you to shout things out.
Hey, Tom, while you're down there in the basement of the ship, get the left-handed smoke shifter. Okay. Oh, you guys, come on, man.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. Relax. You know what? It's fine. We'll tell you about the second-story pool. You can go up there and...
Oh, you guys, come on, man. Tom.
Oh, Tom.
Such a dick. When Tom had placed the instrument in his hand. So Tom gets called out a couple times.
Oh, there you go. Nice. So, yeah, it would be great if Edison was only hired other guys named Tom. That's my weird quirk. What? You don't think it's getting results? I direct your attention to the light bulb.
Tom and Gabe from our serial Batman, yes, are friends. Right. They commiserate after the fact.
Just named guys for a little bit of color that, you know, backfires if you're looking for things to find funny.
Yes.
I like this sentence. It says, all I had read of giants had failed to produce upon my mind the impression of enormous size and tremendous physical energy which the sleeping body of this immense Martian produced. He's done a lot of reading about giants, but it couldn't have been very good reading as it didn't impress upon him their enormous size and tremendous physical energy. So, that seems to be like the one thing that most people have as a takeaway about giants.
Let me see your giant section here in the library. Well, here's our, these are expensive. These run up to $6 or $7 here. You got any cheap giant books that don't really convey the immense weight or anything? Yeah, well, I mean, nobody reads those. Those are very, I'll take a couple of those.
Yeah. Give me the giant books by the bulk. I want them to be referred to as a giant, but I want the author to say that he has no more time to weigh upon any other description of them.
Yeah, it's like at the movie store, you know, there's the Blu-ray section all stacked up on the shelf. Or you can dig through that wire bin for the the terrible giant books. You'll never watch them or anything, but they're like, they're
$3.99. Stocking stuffers for people you don't really care about.
Yes.
Hey, look at here. Edison's Conquest of Mars on DVD. Cool.
Someone's going to love this. My godson is going to love it. This and a bad giant book, and he's ready to go.
So I think that they've, we didn't dwell on the bubble thing too long, but it's very funny to imagine them like shooting that bubble. And then it's either a very fast moving bubble or just sort of like ambles on like towards the enemy. I guess it latches on and, goes towards their face where it then pops as the guy's very slowly watching it approach him. And then he immediately falls down unconscious.
Yeah, I didn't quite get what it was. Was it a glass bubble? Was it a what
was it? I was assuming, a floating soap bubble that just sort of meandered its way down there, like Glinda or something.
Okay, and exploded in the giant's face, and so he's passed out, and then we get. I thought this was a funny diversion. Talk about padding.
Oh my God!
We're in the middle of like we just anesthetized. The hideous demon from hell himself, a giant with a fanny pack and presumably a scrote that we're about to see. Who knows? I don't know.
Oh, man, the skirt is pulled back so far.
Yeah, well, when he fell down, you would think that there'd be a full vision there. Anyway, he talks about how when they were in space, you know, all the wonderful entertainments that they had and everything, but they were just like literally just dicking around with Kelvin, and they were just standing on the wing of the ship. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, Service is like, we're moving in this direction. And so like, if I just stepped off, I'd be going the same speed because there's no difference between the, and then he goes like, I'm going to step off because I could. And Kelvin's like, yeah, but if you apply any force at all in that, you'll just spin off in that direction. I'll never see you again. Like, I know, but I could do it. I'm not going to do it. And that's like 3-4 paragraphs of him describing this stupid thing.
They flash back to him, doing sort of like the old timey like airplane wing walker thing with him and Lord Kelvin.
And Kelvin's like, no, idiot, you can't do that.
So he retrieves boat hooks and fish lines, which they had a lot on their ships of space. And there's multiple subchapter headings of that, like a reckless experiment type of thing. And so like they're doing it and having a blast, indescribable pleasure. But then Edison sort of comes out and it reminded me of like Sam the Eagle with the rest of the Muppets just coming out and being like, you are all weirdos. Edison comes out and is like, I must provide against the danger. If I do not, there is a chance we shall arrive at Mars with the ships half empty and the crews floating helplessly around us, being like, you clowns, settle down out here. We don't need to show up on Mars with everybody orbiting the ship like a bunch of fools.
Yeah, it's like Dwight from The Office, idiots, can't step off the wing. I'm going to make a thing you can clip on so you idiots don't float out into space. So he does. He makes... he makes tenors. Something so that they can do that, yes.
But he did that weeks ago.
He has a machine shop on board, apparently.
Yeah, he's inventing all sorts of stuff. He invents something else that reveals itself shortly as well. And I the illustration of them doing that wing walking is also quite funny because I think it's the first look we get at their spacesuits, and it really looks like a homemade Spider-Man or Deadpool costume someone would wear to Comic-Con. Like not an accurate one, but like, your dad gets tasked with making your Halloween costume and this is what he comes up with.
Yes. Yeah. it does not look comfortable and I don't understand how they get it over their head because the neck sort of, I don't know. Again, it could be three pieces or something, right. But check out the drawing.
Yeah.
But then he says, hey, sorry about that little side thing. We should get back to, the anesthetized Martian here. So they do. And then they calculate his weight.
Oh, my God.
In a thrilling, thrilling scene. This is what you're doing right now? And they all seem, every time he does this, everyone is absorbed in it.
Yeah, they all gather around and sort of be like, oh, yeah, what's your calculation? Have you come up with it yet, Garrett P. Service?
Well, I knew that my weight being 150 pounds on Earth. So I wondered about that. Do you think that's Garrett being, you know, like, well, I that was my weight when I was 27. I mean,
my weight of 150 pounds and 2% body fat, ladies, should be on the asteroid an ounce and a half. Won't affect the body fat, ladies, but I...
Have I had a few bowls of walnuts and some port since then? Maybe. I don't know. That's but, roughly what I am.
So, yeah, he calculates that on the asteroid, he expects to weigh an ounce and a half, and then he's shocked. He's just shocked when he steps on the asteroid, and it comes out to be 5 ounces and a quarter. Because he's done all this math, you know, blah, 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 Earth's ratio, 1 to 1600, because he's looked at the asteroid and been like, that looks like it's about 5 miles wide. And so all this thing is hinging on this estimation from what I can gather of this asteroid site. And so when it comes off by 3.5 ounces, 4.5 ounces, that it's he's just like beside himself. But he's if the planet was like 5.14 miles, it probably would explain for a lot of that.
The fact that they're so nobody goes like, well, just check his math, or did you? How did you calculate? Nobody asked that. They're all like, my God,
yeah,
this is surely this astounds. Meanwhile, there's a sleeping Martian next to him.
How long does that anesthesia last? By the way, Edison.
He looks like he's moving. Ah, he's fine. Yeah, and they all, and even Professor Sylvanus P. Thompson weighs in.
Oh, nice.
Perhaps it is the fault in the asteroid, suggested Professor SPT. Quite so, exclaimed LK. That's Lord Kelvin, of course.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then the only answer, all right, so you're faced with this. What is your answer? Mine would be, you idiots probably made an error. It just is what it is. Why do you care?
The guy who couldn't hack it as a lawyer, so he became a newspaper reporter, probably forgot to carry the two, is my answer. Right. And he misjudged the estimation of the planet being 5 miles wide.
That's sound thinking, but I have another. The planet is made of gold. The truth had flashed upon us.
Yeah.
That... What?
It reminded me, so like read this, it says, Lord Kelvin is saying, a look of sudden comprehension overspreading his features, no doubt is the internal constitution of the asteroid which is the cause of the anomaly. And so this is very much Monty Python and determining whether something's a witch. We must look into that. Let me see, the gentleman's weight is 3.5 times as great as it ought to be. What element is there whose density exceeds the mean density of the Earth in about that proportion? Gold? Gold! And then they start shrieking like prospectors.
Yep, they start firing their pistols into the ground and dancing around. Tom, who knows what Tom is doing? Maybe Tom was the one who went, gold?
Yeah.
And then everyone else pretended like that was the answer, even though it's clearly not. Yeah, gold, right.
Where is the gold? In the hills, up to them thar hills. And they take it as a fact. They say it's covered up in course in space dust, says Lord Kelvin. And so everyone, you know, again, a Martian who's rapidly approaching the end of his anesthesia is lying there, but they are they are struck with gold rush fever.
We must dig down, and then doubtless we shall find the metal.
Incredible.
I mean, that's like, you know, Geraldo with the vault, right? Like, I mean, I don't understand. There certainly should have been gold here.
And this is, again, one of those moments where he is unable to come up with anything better than it being gold. You know, it could be Martianium. It could be unobtainium, for God's sakes. Mm-hmm. You know, something you could say it's 1,000 times more valuable than gold, and there you go. It's even better. But oh no, they just found some gold. That's going to be happy. Everyone's going to be happy about that.
It's like This Island Earth, the movie we did for the MST movie, when the guy looks at the plans for what is called an interocitor, which is just, and he looks at the plans that the deep voiced hero, and he goes, why, with this, you could build freeways at a mile a minute. That's the best they could think
Wow,
of.
That's hilarious.
It's the same. Well, it must be gold. You don't think it'd be something that could, like, feed our population for 700 years or power us? Yeah. That's just gold.
Immediate fusion that could eliminate the need for all of the gasoline-powered cars. No, nope. build freeways faster.
Yes, a mile a minute.
They go on to say, I don't know what this means. It's sort of like Bob Craney text. Gold is a thing which may make its appearance anywhere and at any time without offering any excuses or explanations.
I wish I could take the photo of that right now. That is literally the word next to that sentence that I have. Huh? Gold is a thing which may make its appearance. I think he's saying this as an aspirational thing. That's the only thing I can figure. Is that I don't, hey, if gold wants to appear, I don't want it to offer any excuses. I think that's the only thing he could be saying,
okay.
Right? He's not saying that gold doesn't need to, I don't know what.
Yeah, I think it's a sentence that he lost track of halfway through it.
And then comes, I just have to read this whole thing. This was a huge surprise. This was, again, if I had a mouthful of Slurpee, this would have been the Slurpee spit take all over my 27-inch screen. About the gold, exclaimed one. Of course. What else was there to fight about? This is their surmising that they had a civil war over the gold.
Yes.
At this instance, one of our men came running from a considerable distance, waving his arms. Blah, blah, blah. There are a lot of dead Martians over there, he said. They've been cleaning one another out. That's it, said Mr. Edison. I knew it when I saw the condition of those machines. Then it is not a wrecked expedition directed against the Earth? Not at all. This must be the great gold mine of Mars, said the president of an Australian mining company, opening both his eyes and his mouth as he spoke. Couple of questions.
Several.
Number one, you're here? This right, mate. I came on the ship, mate. And then the other question is, why are you opening both your eyes and mouth as you speak? And I gave it, obviously, I articulated it because I was trying to convey what he said, but
yes.
What?
Yes. So is that not how everyone technically speaks? You know, like if I'm trying to say without opening my mouth as I spoke, this kind of tricky, super hard to convey an Australian accent. And it would be quite weird if this guy was speaking to you without opening both of his eyes, if he was just like holding one of them shut at you.
Oh, yeah. I guess I was, you know, I was reading it as super opening his eyes and opening his mouth. But I guess just they naturally are open. You're right.
So that begs the question of, I probably used that phrase wrong, but is this a weird ethnic stereotype about Australians from the late 1800s? Not known for not doing this, known for speaking at you, saying, you know, questioning the size of your knife, but with their eyes closed as they were doing it, leaving you to wonder how they're able to ascertain your knife's worthiness.
That would be that's a great stereotype. Yeah.
You know those Australians, how they'll come up to you and inform you that your baby is missing, drugging off by a pack of wild dogs, but they'll have their eyes closed the whole time. It's quite insensitive.
Yes. Especially when they own gold mines that we feel the need to fly them to other planets. They especially open their eyes and mouth when they speak to you.
Yeah.
Bunch of criminals. That's what they are.
But yeah, so he's there. No, if they had called out a specific one, that would have been great. Maybe there was a specific Australian mining company guy who, you know, much like Yahoo Sirius, became famous for 6 months in America and sort of toured around, and everyone thought that's what every Australian was like. And so by dropping this guy here, they've just called everyone back to that peculiar time in American history in like 1896 when a president of an Australian mining company was the toast of the town.
Oh, yeah, that must, you know, so people are reading this around, you know, at their breakfast table at the elegant hotel, and they get to this section of it, and the Australian man appears, and then the newspaper shakes lightly before they eat their poached egg. And, whatever is it you're laughing at, dear? It's a very amusing thing in this little Martian story I'm reading. They reference the Australian chap. You remember him? Well, of course I do. Delightfully.
What has he been up to? He had such a unique hairstyle.
he spoke with such an animated manner. His eyes were open the entire time.
Yes, quite. We should visit Australia one of these days. Yes.
I never want to do that.
Of course, I would ensure security if we were to visit there, honey.
How large would your utensil be that you brought along with you? Would it be sharp?
Too big to go down there. You would not want to travel with anything. I would equip all the men with machetes so that they... although then you bring into questioning whether that's a knife or not. Machetes.
That's exactly what I was thinking,
kind of
dear.
Tend to be a sword. I don't know. Are they going to come out with another Australian stereotype? Like, those are all from the 1980s, I feel like. Dingo, Yahoo Serious, and knife questioning. I need something else, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, it's been a while, Australia. Let's step up your game. What do you got for us?
You provide us with the stereotype. That's what we want. Come on. Yes. There was one thing just right before that was also just another random guy's contribution to this thing, because they're saying they're looking at the gold. They're thinking, won't we be rich? Exclaimed a voice. How are we going to dig it and get back to Earth? Asked another. Carry it in your pockets, said one.
Damn it, Tom.
Tom.
Go get another smoke ball.
You see any pockets on these spacesuits, Tom? We threw the design together really quickly. If we had a fanny pack, that might make it pretty easy, but no.
Now we see how smart those Martians are. Yeah. Here's the top scientist, by the way. Had the celestial mind been easier to reach, perhaps they would have removed more, or possibly their political economists perfectly understood the necessity of properly controlling the amount of precious metal in circulation. Very likely, we thought, the mining operations were under government control in Mars, and it might be that the majority of the people there knew nothing of the store of wealth floating in the firmament.
Incredible.
Wait, we're agreeing on this, guys? We all think this?
We all think the government of Mars has adapted some sort of, like, quantitative easing program here on this asteroid, which he emphasizes is still millions of miles away from Mars.
That was astonishing to me. I thought they were just right next to Mars.
So yeah, they're controlling the supply of this lest it devalue their currency or something.
That's obvious. Assumed quite this, likely.
Yes. Oh man, the lack of imagination, it's hilarious.
Oh, their government keeping the mine secret from the people and meting out the amount of gold.
And I believe they think these are like pirates who came there essentially to like raid the supply. They were then stranded there, I think, in the Civil War with the government, who was, which makes sense. You can't just have people printing more money.
Why don't they, another writing, to me, forced error, the Martian lying there, you go over to him, you pull out Edison. Oh, you didn't know I have a universal communicator. You did not know that? And then, ray to his head, tell us why you're here. What happened here? No, never. And then, all right, I'll tell you. We were mining this. The government controls the amount of gold that we give to our people. But pirates came and destroyed our ships.
Right.
Like, aha, the truth is revealed.
Assuming, constantly making these assumptions based on your own Earth experiences and having them be disproven wrong over and over again would be another funny thing to have happened. Instead of just like, I stuck my finger in my mouth and held it up to test the wind and immediately knew what was happening here.
Yes.
This is a great old-timey-ism, I think. And did people talk this way? I guess they did sometimes used to say thousands of millions. So this is Professor... Professor Moisson, the great French chemist, he says, my meaning is that the Martian must have, for that he may live, the nitrogen and the oxygen. Just like a grandparent saying to look it up on the Google or something like that.
It's like when you, in old-timey things that we see, when they talk about protein. Yes. He's eating his protein. So that he does not become a robot.
Yes, those are the two. Maybe people used to say that, but it's a hilarious thing to put in front of an element.
There's in an old-timey thing that we did about sport and snow sports, I think. There was one where they were towing a person on skis with a horse. Mm-hmm. And the narrator said, they call it sheeing. And this is when they tow someone like that, it's called whoring. So this is she-whoring. She-whoring. Come no on, one man. Calls it that.
Yeah, there's a J. Just be an American, pronounce it, or, you know, pronounce it that way.
Ah, yes.
Well, I think that's the end of this chapter. Where does this... Oh, yeah, so it ends with a classic servicism. There's a signal from a ship that they receive. Then the subtitle heading, "The Martians are coming." It was reported that the Martians were coming. End of chapter. You guys can wait two weeks to probably read until the next installment of this publishes in the newspaper.
So, yeah, hits you with the powerful sentence, "The Martians are coming." I'm like, oh, wow, the Martians are coming. Hang on. Let me state it more passively to end this chapter. It was reported that the Martians were coming. Ah, now my pulse is racing.
Tom reported to us that the machine indicated that the Martians were coming.
And, M-dash, we stood in a circle and all agreed that very likely, in fact, Martians were, if there were to be Martians, in fact, coming at that moment. Kelvin said, right, quite right.
Sylvanus P. Thompson pulled out a pocket calendar and indicated that it was nearing the end of the third fiscal quarter, which we assumed they keep the same as us, so they were probably coming to replenish their gold supplies to enable to incur the debts which are amortized at the end of a quarter.
If you will allow it, a little sidebar about Lord Kelvin. We shared a laugh over the fact that his tobacco purse had come undone in the deep void of space. So he screwed his monocle into his eye and things were right as rain again. Anyway, always want to leave you on a laugh. Yeah. So there you are.
Tip top. There we go. It's also hilarious when you compare it to, I think we looked through them and published them on the intro episode, the cover of some of Garrett P. Service's novels, where it's like people like looking in horror as these like crab men emerge from a UFO type of thing. And then yes. What you actually get in here is, yeah, discussion of implied economic policies and artificial constraint of supplies.
From 100 guys standing around in the circle. We all agree the government's control. Yes, of course. All right, let's gavel it shut then.
All right, well, that's the end of that chapter. Before chapter 8, though, let's move into some fanfic. Real fanfic. All right, so this is Real or Fanfic, the segment where we are going to quiz Mike on 5 segments that are either from later in Edison's Conquest of Mars or fanfic written by our loyal Patreon jackals. At patreon.com/372pages. Patreon, we did a fun thing last week where it was Groundhog Day, and a listener pointed out that there was no Groundhog Day cozy mysteries.
Yeah.
Which is stunning. So we each pitched each other our theme for a Groundhog Day cozy mystery. Those turned out pretty fun.
That was. I saw someone said they would they'd read them both. So pitch accomplished. They wouldn't give us an advance on writing them, of course, but they would read them once they were written.
Yeah, or they'd like, you know, see that we had done it and be like, I'll get around to that someday, sure.
Sure, yeah, I'll read those.
And 19 people away from watching Forrest Gump, so whenever that right. Whenever that hits, that'll be a big moment. I don't know how we will watch that. I think the thing we used to watch them on Scener went out of business, so.
It did.
Hope that's not an impediment to that, but we'll figure something out. But,
yeah, watch so, party. There's things to have a watch party.
Yeah, it might be built into Amazon or something. Well, we appreciate everybody. Thank you for supporting the podcast. Here are the Real or Fanfic segments. Number one. The professor's agitation was so great that he could go no further. And indeed, there was not one of us who did not fully share his excitement. To think that we should have come to the planet Mars to solve one of the standing mysteries of the Earth, which had puzzled mankind and defied all their efforts at solution for so many centuries. Here, then, was the explanation of how those gigantic blocks that constitute the Great Pyramid of Cheops had been swung to their lofty elevation. It was not the work of puny men, as many an engineer had declared it could be, that it could not be, but the work of these giants of Mars.
I like that one. Yeah, I'll say that that's real.
Okay. Number two. This has a subchapter headings. Inside the Souterrain. The subterranean area of the Martian's compound was, as close as I could figure it, over a mile wide with structural pillars placed at intervals of about 25 feet. The ceiling of this otherworldly cave, which must have been a truly daunting size even to the Martians, bore the protrusions of stalactites, which hung over our heads like the sword of Damocles. "Look here," said Mr. Edison, pointing up at the teeth-like outgrowths. I could tell that his genius mind was working on a problem that remained unseen by the rest of us. "Do you not see the significance?" It seemed that despite the many intellectuals present, none could provide the solution he was looking for. Mr. Edison turned to me, hoping that I might yet answer in the affirmative. "It is all quite simple, really," he assured me. The next subheading, Water on Mars. "Of course," I ejaculated suddenly. "Why didn't I see it before? Water! The presence of spilotherms in this cave means there must have been water here once."
Wow. Using the, speaking of Holmes, Watson was always ejaculating.
Oh, God.
It was constant.
Wow.
Whew. Yeah. I feel like, did we have Sword of Damocles? I felt like that was in the book before. I don't know. I might be wrong about that, but I'm going to say that's fanfic.
I think there was a Sword of Damocles in the last section. Number three. "This is the only way," Edison, surrounded by Martian guards, told us. "Impossible!" Edison outstretched his arms. "There is no room for debate, my friends. My decision is made. I will design Martian technology until my dying breath. In exchange, they will never attack Earth again." "We shan't let this stand!" "What is the life of one compared to that of an entire civilization?" Edison explained. I wish we could all share his stoicism, but none could approach the dignity of that man. I even saw Lord Kelvin shed some tears. "There won't be a child in all of Earth's history who won't know the name Edison," someone cried.
Oh, that's very good. I mean, I hope, but I think that's fanfic.
Okay. Number four. Tesla. At last, the niggling detail that had vexed our intrepid leader made itself manifest, since Mr. Edison had invented our wonderful electric vehicles, which had caused him to wonder at why the Martians' projectile cars had been so comparatively clumsy. It appears that the Martians had made a secret trip to our Earth before their devastating attack and taken a hostage. Poor fortune for Nikola Tesla, who seemed to have been captured, but also poor fortune for the Martians. Could it be that he was the source of the Martians' projectile cars? It would seem plausible, given that Tesla had studied under Mr. Edison and had showed some, though comparatively small, genius in the fields of electrics and science.
A slam on Tesla. I think that's fanfic.
Okay. And number five. This is a subheading, "A Most Industrious and Dedicated Race." As Martians grew even larger in our telescopic view, we could now discern the finer detail of activity in the Martian cities, finding they fell into regular cycles of activity. Each morning at dawn, the multitude of giants would organize themselves into long queues of surface cars, slowly progressing from residence to factory for hours at a time. Slowly, the path to the factories would clear, and great clouds of smoke would go up from the great engines of the Martians' daily enterprises, obscuring their activity. Long after sunset, moving and flashing lights penetrated the clouds of smoke, signaling the reversal of the morning procession, but with the Martians transversing much more slowly. "They are a most industrious, dedicated race," Mr. Edison observed. "They are eager to work and reluctant to leave their productive pursuit. The men of Earth should follow such a disciplined example."
Wow, goods and services.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that that's fanfic.
Okay. All right. Well, I think last week you were either three for five.
I was three for five.
Well, I think you've done yourself proud in this round. Let's see. Number one was the pyramid being made by the Martians. You said real for that. That is real.
Yes.
From later in the book.
Right.
Submitted by Craig. That's pretty nuts. How long ago do you think people started thinking that kind of... that kind of ancient aliens kind of thing.
Oh, I think that's an old, right? Isn't that like, we don't understand it, therefore aliens, right?
I guess so, but it's still pretty funny.
Yeah.
Number two, that was inside the Souterrain, stalactites, water on Mars, ejaculating. You said fanfic. That was fanfic.
Wow.
Written
nice.
By Edmund. Number three, that was... Edison volunteering to stay behind, which I feel like is a pretty a pretty 1950s B plot, B movie plot. You said fanfic for that. That was fanfic written by Harris.
Yeah, I think it's good. The only reason I didn't bite on it was that I was thinking that the editor would be like, no, 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 send him back. We need him again for the sequel. Yeah. I mean, we could always jet. He could always jet in on one of his electric ships. But I don't know, for whatever reason.
we need to have the victory parade when he arrives back here. Number four was Tesla being abducted by the Martians previously and making inferior ships. You said fanfic for that. That was fanfic. Written by Hayden. No word. I've not searched for Tesla in this book, but we'll see. And number five was the most industrious and dedicated race, hardworking Martians reluctant to leave their jobs. We should all emulate them. You said fanfic for that. That was fanfic written by Craig. So a 5 for 5.
Woohoo!
Shot the moon. Well done. Well done.
Wow.
Yeah. Well done.
Yeah, I feel good about it. Those were all good, too. I don't... It was not like that was obvious.
No, I don't think so. I don't think there was anything, you know, super wacky. The sword of Damocles, I think, might have been a tell. And
yeah, that was the only possible tell, but that was, I wasn't even sure about that.
So. Tesla was a little goofy, I think, but yeah, well done.
Know. They're probably going to use Tesla, like you said. They were going to just substitute his name anyway, right?
I've never paid any, attention to that, just because it's something that, I don't know, nerds yelling about Tesla and how great he was online is like, I'm not wading into any of this. So I don't, were they actually just like in the papers being like Edison versus Tesla?
Yes, they were. And I think that Tesla's a more fascinating dude. And I understand why nerds think it's like, cause he weirdly, you know, died in a strange way and had all these secrets. And I don't know if it's all just lore built up around it, but like, secret experiments being conducted, you know, and things that just, I don't know. He was a weird genius. Cool. Who was ahead of his time. So a lot of speculation, but yeah.
Well, that'd be fun if they brought him into that. I guess we'll have to see. But let's move on to chapter 8.
Let us do that. Chapter 8. I have notes? Oh, yeah, I have to have notes for it.
You better.
I read it.
The Martians are coming, and I did like that he had... perceived them as a glittering object moving from the direction of the ruddy planet.
Yeah.
Which is like a rebranding campaign for Mars that never caught on.
especially since in the British, like that ruddy planet just means like that shaggy old planet. Edison says, they do not know that we are here, he said, and I am convinced that they are unable to control their motions as we can do with our electrical ships.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you were also pretty convinced they didn't have a death ray, too, weren't you?
Yeah.
Convinced that comets weren't going to drag us back to Earth.
Yeah, he keeps blowing it. But then I think every time he blows it, that's when he reveals something else that he's been working on in his workshop that he can just distract them with again.
Yeah, it is the you never have to say you're sorry when you're deeply wrong about something, right? It's like, well, you know, this is all science corrects itself. What are you going to do? Yeah, well, hundreds of our guys are dead.
Right. But yeah, he thinks that despite the fact that they like came down and wiped out, you know, thousands of millions of people on Earth, that they don't even have a means of like, you know, slowing themselves down as they get to the planet. He thinks they have no means of producing or controlling electrical attraction or repulsion, so they have to just rely on the planet's gravitational pull to like pull them in once they get there. And it says that they could see projecting from the four part of their car at least two of the polished knobs whose fearful use and power we well comprehended.
Yeah, the polished knobs are coming. but they so the polished knobs, the same thing, of course. But we were not to get the victory quite so easily. There was another of the war engines in the car, and before we could concentrate our fire upon it, its awful flash shot forth, and a dozen of our comrades perished before our eyes.
Nice.
It's Tom? Australian mine owners? Just our comrades?
His final words were crikey, and that's how we know who it was.
He just gets he gets vague at times where I was like, come on, man. I want to see like Tom's arm spun out into space, you know.
Or Edison, you know, Edison, like, you know, only thing that like puts a dent into his stoic countenance. And so he speculates, you know, Tom must have been more than just a friend.
Tom, oh, God, your touch.
So I think that's the body count is at 55 so far. So,
okay.
You know, that's only... That's like 3% of the crew.
I keep saying 100. Did you say 1,000?
People who are on the thing?
Yeah, how many are going
2,000 people, 100 ships.
2,000, so okay.
55 sorry. Dead, yes. 3 ships destroyed.
Okay.
they were destroyed by the death-dealing knob of the war engine.
The death-dealing knob.
And he sort of gets into it. They've been talking about their disintegrators, and you know they've done a little bit of like, oh yeah, you could just like turn the dial, try to dial it into whatever frequency you need to disintegrate. But then he throws in a little bit of, he's getting ahead of like the why don't the Eagles just fly the rings into Mount Doom stuff. He's like, oh, but the Eagles, the disintegrators were like firearms, and that after each discharge they must be readjusted before they can be used again. So that throws like a little bit of drama into this whole shootout scene that's happening.
It does seem a little, though, like Edison...
could have told us that?
Well, yes. Who's the... I always forget her name. The blood testing lady.
Oh, Elizabeth Holmes?
Elizabeth. No, he's doing a little bit of that. Like, yeah. Well, of course we can't do that now, but you never asked me when we were testing, when I destroyed that wall. Well, you made it seem like you could just point it at the wall and the wall was gone. Like, well, you know, if you took that away from that thing, that's on you.
Come on, guys. This is what I showed you when we were disintegrating that crow's feathers. This is.
We know that's not your real voice, Edison. Why are you doing that?
What are you talking about? Did Tom tell you that?
Damn it, Tom.
So, yeah, the shootout is happening, and it's sort of like you said before, the Saving Private Ryan, like the tunnel vision noise, ears ringing, people freaking out. People, he says, in the presence of danger, many of them had lost all self-command. So I imagine that's, you know, fill in their pants type of thing. Half dozen people had dropped their disintegrators, or other people were standing fast as if frozen in their tracks. So people are really sort of like, shell-shocked here.
This comports with reality. I think anytime a citizen soldiers like see their first taste of war, they say like they just know that like 40% of them will just run.
God.
But a particular slander on that's just across the population, right? 40%. Here we get a real call out. The electricians lose their heads. So. Any contractors out there in the electrical trades, what's up with you guys?
Yeah, really?
You guys freeze? Like, one of them is standing there with the thing pointed at one of them, who's going to, you know, kill them with his polished knob.
Yeah.
And he's just frozen.
Yeah. Service is pretty much has to resort to giving him the get yourself together, man, face slaps. Like, yeah. He gets him on the shoulder, and like, because he says to seize it would have been taking too much time. So he has to hit him, and that like snaps the guy back into it, and he is able to like fire it and shoot it at the Martians.
So, but it also made me think like, okay, so this is like World War I, where they would recruit an entire small town of men, and they would put them in the same unit.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, like one bomb would destroy them all, and so all the a single town's men would die on the same day. Like, electricians, get together in a small tight group near the polished knob, all electricians.
Guys who maintain the oxygen system on board, you guys run as the first flank. Yes. All the doctors will be right behind you.
Very odd strategy.
No chain of succession going on here.
No. And then chapter heading, which I think is like a great musical too, saved! Exclamation point. Next sentence, we were saved. So they blew up the polished knob.
Yeah, not before four of our men rushing towards them and fell in heaps of cinders. So just, I'm tracking it now. That's 59 dead.
Okay.
And this is important because, you know, there has been... so that's, I think, how many people just died? Oh, a dozen died by the, so the Martians have killed 17 people. 40 were killed by the, asteroid or whatever, the comet stuff. By the Martians, death race, right? The knobs evaporated two whole ships. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people dead in this past 24 hours. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah. This is a terrible, terrible battle. This is like Hamburger Hill where like, oh my God, we've taken it, but at what cost?
Yes. So then you get the next chapter heading after save, which is a curious effect. And so they're like running towards the other Martians, or just scope out the wreckage of what they've blasted. And he says, the slight attraction of the planet and their consequent almost entire lack of weight enabled the men to run with immense speed. The result, as I subsequently learned, was that after they had disappeared from our view, they quitted the planet entirely, the force being sufficient to partially free them from its gravitation. So they sailed out into space, whirring helplessly end over end, until the elliptical orbits in which they traveled eventually brought them back again to the planet on the side nearly opposite to that which they had departed. So people just start running after that, and then they realize that the planet works like, I don't know if you ever played Super Mario Galaxy, but you can just jump off, sail all the way around, and it will like land on the other end of the planet. So guys just start going out there and just start having a blast testing out this new thing they've discovered, just doing like long jumps, like, look at me, how far I can go.
And so the Martians, did they know that? Like, all we have to do, we just have to run. And then we do like, whoopee, and you know, then we're on the other side of the planet. And then they're like covering their mouth and giggling like they're never going to find us, because they're going to run at like a normal speed and not launch themselves off the planet.
I don't know. But it's a it just once you've ever like played that game, it's exactly what he's describing. So I guess he did get ahead of something.
I did think of there's another one. It's maybe that it copied it, but a Ratchet and Clank that we used to play. Mm-hmm. Of one of those versions where he would explore tiny planets. And it was really fun to like stride around the entire planet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so yeah, I guess service was onto something here.
Yeah, service is selling. So they hunt for the enemy. And they just like want to fire. So a bunch of the cowards basically stayed in the ships and didn't engage in the battle.
Yes.
Is kind of what we're learning.
Yes.
And so now we learn that these cowards, I guess, again, someone grabbed them by the shoulders and went, get a hold of yourself. And they realize, like, oh, gosh, all right, we should probably join the battle. So they start firing their disintegrators on the Martian ship.
Yeah.
And then there's a photo of it. They are just, this is like, because it's a battle, we're going to use a lot, Saving Private Ryan. Like, they get to the pillbox, and they just, like, torch the... The blood is in their nostrils, you know. So, God, son of a... Ah! So they just empty grenades into it and fire on it and open up their machine guns at full auto and just unload it on these Martians.
Yeah, it's incredible. It says it describes it as a rapid massacre. It says the effect of the disintegrators had been awful, too repulsive indeed to be described in detail. And yeah, the picture is them. It's another side view of these oddly dressed Martians, but their hair in the back. I mean, not their hair. The bulge in behind, which I assume is their huge brain. It looks sort of like when a Rasta guy has his dreads back in one of those huge caps they wear to do that. They've really like got something in the back of their head like that as they're being blasted here.
Yeah, it also looks like that's how the Elephant Man, he had an unfortunate growth that just came off the back of his head. It looks like that, just a weird, big, fat thing on his on their skulls. But luckily, I mean, for them, because they're hideous demon creatures, yeah. They get completely evaporated.
And we get a little bit of cold-bloodedness. It's in the chapter heading, The Disintegrator's Awful Effect. Service says... because they wipe out all the Martians, and then they see the guy who they had gassed and tied up. They say, that fellow is afraid at last. I said to Mr. Ederson, well, I should think he ought to be afraid, was the reply. As they've disintegrated and massacred everybody else that he is his countrymen.
I like that. So he does that line, which, you know, should be the end of a chapter, should be a Sylvanus P. Thompson like action line. That son of a bitch ought to be afraid, was the reply. And then Service like, so he ought. But if I'm not mistaken, the sphere of his may be the beginning of a new discovery for us. Like, damn it,
Service.
Like, that was an outline, you son of a.
You don't need a me too. Yes and my quips.
Yeah, you're putting a hat on a hat, dipshit.
But then comes they've massacred everybody. There's smoldering bodies. I assume that the Martians, since they're so ugly, smell terrible when they've been disintegrated and stuff like that. The guy is quaking. They're still like mourning the loss of their 47 fallen comrades. you know, they're like, should we go back to the moon and bury these guys? Should we bury them here type of thing? But then Lord Kelvin gets an idea. it says it's one of the most laughable things imaginable to see Lord Kelvin dressed in his airtight suit making tremendous jumps into empty space. And he just sort of gets up there and just sort of tests the gravity, because it says on this little planet, the acceleration of gravity or the velocity required by a falling body in 1 second was only 4/5 of an inch. So a body required an entire minute to fall a distance of only 120 feet. And he says it appeared like a bunch of guys start doing it. And he uses a metaphor that I'm very familiar with. He says it appeared like so many gigantic marionettes bobbing up and down in a pneumatic bottle. So I don't know if that was like a major form of entertainment where it's like, you know, honey, fetch the nickels. We're going to go and watch marionettes bob up and down at the pneumatic bottle at the fair tonight. But
That was one of the entertainments they brought along for that. Yeah.
Here it is at a larger scale. But everyone just starts doing that. Edison says, let's try it. And then the next subchapter heading is a delightful experience.
What they don't point out, though, is that this was Kelvin like dancing on the grave of one of his comrades who was sleeping with his wife. And he was like, son of a... what a delightful thought. Like, no, I am tromping on his grave.
Yeah, call his wife right now and tell her the bad news. And I want to be in the background so you can hear me going, woo-hoo. And it says our entire company might have remained for an indefinite period enjoying this new kind of athletic exercise in a world where gravitation had become so humble that it could be trifled with. What would the New Yorkers who you had just teased, you know, by landing back on Earth after 2 weeks think about this, you idiots?
Again, it is what, D-Day plus two, they're sitting in a burnt out church in Saint-Marie-Glace just like putting on a puppet show and making each other laugh hysterically.
Guys' hands are shaking as they try to light a cigarette and other people are like just,
woohoo! Yeah. Marionettes are funny.
They do some experiments, which are claimed to be interesting experiments with the gold, because again, they are still very focused on that. And the guy had suggested putting it in their pockets, but they decide that like they can chuck it back at the Earth. They start tossing gold.
I assumed they were going to do the Bugs Bunny thing of throw it around the planet.
Oh yeah, his fastball. Yeah.
But it's like, no, it won't take much, like a little leaguer's arm to get it out of into space to break the, you know, the gravitational pull and throw it to Earth.
Yeah. And so they're imagining, you know, some prospector finding it and finding a new bonanza. I think they're thinking like, ha-ha, that guy will think there's gold here. I was imagining, you know, crashing through the roof of a children's hospital or something. Just destroying, you know, someone's home as this, you know, asteroid hits the ground from this heavy metal.
Again, I wish I could take a picture of my notes, because it says, there's a chance that some, if the aim were true, might survive the fiery passage through the atmosphere and fall upon the surface of our planet. And I have, or hit a children's hospital. Oh so God.
We've worked together for too long.
Yeah, too long.
Oh. And so that's how they spend the blowing off a little steam after the 50 deaths. They do some trampolining and then toss around some gold for fun and bring some back with them, of course, as the chapter ends.
Yeah, and don't they, to hit Earth, doesn't one of them go like, where is it?
Yeah, yeah.
They say, oh, there it is. It's right there. Just throw in that direction. And you'll hit Earth?
Yeah, he seems very convinced that the gravitational pulls, they've got them all, you know, figured out. So they chuck it in the general area and, like throwing a rock into a pond. It'll get to the bottom.
And then someone goes, you know, as they're like all celebrating the fact that that's going to be so hilarious when someone finds a chunk of gold. And then Tom goes like, what if a comet comes by? God damn it, Tom!
Ugh!
You didn't see the last one? Shut up, Tom!
I wish you were number 56, Tom.
All right, chapter 9.
Chapter 9, yeah. We
half of chapter 9.
Half of this, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, brother, they just start talking about how difficult it is to get off the thing because of the different gravity or some nonsense. So, you know, they have a slightly exciting section here and then just kill it by some, probably accurate but unnecessary science. And then they reveal that they're still 6 million miles and 23 days away from Mars.
Okay, that was a complete... I thought they were looking at Mars.
I thought
right?
they were too. I mean, I guess you can, I don't know, you could probably see it like in the background. I mean, we could see Mars from here, so maybe they were just seeing it gradually getting bigger but still looking like a star or something.
I guess it's like taking the road trip from I'll use my hometown of Minneapolis to Florida, and it takes forever, and then you get to Florida and you go like, "Woohoo, we're here."
Miami. Oh,
we've still got
580 miles.
So much more to go. I guess that's what it was. But I assume they were just like, you know, like now we just hop, skip, and a jump over to Mars.
Yeah, that was the
6 million miles away.
But I mean, they sort of yada yadded over the previous 20, you know, 19 days or whatever they've done so far with various entertainments. So hopefully that's what they're prepared to do in this situation.
But up until then, so they're taking the they're taking the air pills and they're folding them in little bits of hamburger and forcing them down the throat of the Martian.
Rub his throat. That's how you do it.
They're putting it in a hose and blowing it down the throat of this Martian. So they just resume the many entertainments they have on board. So more, you know, marionettes and pneumatic jars. And
No, pneumatic jar guy was one of the guys that got vaporized.
Oh, shoot.
Anyone else able to operate one of those?
That was so funny.
Does anyone have a pith ball? I don't know. Like, watch that drip.
Kelvin could jump up and down a bit. Like, eh, I'm over that.
Yeah, that's
it's old.
Yesterday's catchphrase. But they decide they're going to learn the Martians' language, and this had some various, oh man, I don't know, I think they're making light of things. I think these are like what we're going to get that are close to jokes here, so I want to share them because there were a bunch of linguists on board. They thought ahead about that. This one says, an American linguist says, "We shall not find them making he's and she's of stone, sticks, and other inanimate objects. They must certainly have gotten rid of all that nonsense long ago." So is that like a slam on Spanish?
Well, a slam on any of the languages with, French as well, right? Yeah. And then I'm like, oh, okay, so said a French professor from the Sorbonne, one of the makers of the never-to-be-finished dictionary. Take that, French. Sure. It will be like the language of my country. Transparent, similar to the diamond, and sparkling as is the fountain. So I didn't get that joke. Like, you, I understand that the French are very proud of their language. That's fine. That's a thing. But they have he's and she's of sticks and stones. So I don't, like, does he just, that's the joke or something? The French guy doesn't even
understand.
Get that I'm, like, slamming his language?
If you just punch the American guy in the face. And what's the never-to-be-finished dictionary? They've got like Chinese Democracy, the Guns N' Roses albums of the dictionary over there.
I think it's just a joke that their language is never, but I think they do have an official. I don't know. I don't know what the joke is. Why am I speculating?
Right. Yeah, sure.
I don't know.
That's, I mean, 1898 humor there. Australian mine
right.
owners. That could be that.
Right.
And then the German guy says, "I think it will be a universal language, the Volapük of Mars, spoken by all the inhabitants of that planet." And then Edison's like, "Settle the hell down. All these speculations do not help you much. Like, go find out what he calls himself." God, idiots.
And then, of course, this is good. This is finally 1898 becomes itself.
Yeah.
"If our prisoner had been a stupid savage, of course any such attempt as this to make him understand would have been idle." You know, a stupid savage like 97% of the globe. We all know what we're talking about here, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the stupid savages wreaked havoc, destroyed, you know, many of your cities. You're still rebuilding neighborhoods in New York. Like, you know, maybe dial it back just a touch if you've been owned by them. Like, I didn't call the guy who beat me on Jeopardy an idiot because he, like, didn't know, like, the answer to a talking heads question. It's like, I got thoroughly owned. Like, I'm going to dial back the criticism.
I forgot this, and I just have to bring it up because I think I referenced it with you. I love old-timey words. I like to collect them. After seeing the men die in Chapter 8, of course the people who came to, you know, join the battle, of course they were chap fallen by what had happened. That was a word I have never, ever in my life, I don't think, have read. My eyes have never been upon that word.
It's amazing.
Chap fallen. I only bring it up because there's another word that ends this chapter. Oh, so nice. We'll get to that. But
now, Simpson, I see you're quite chap fallen at the demotion to nuclear inspector, but
looking at the shape of your jowls look rather chapfallen.
So that would have been one that would have been, if someone had selected that as a fanfic, that would have been a one being like, what? All right, you've given yourself away here.
Yeah.
But yeah, he disses the savages of the world. So it's like, settle down here, service. And then we get the Martian speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Which I might need you to do the song challenge. I'm getting over a cold and my throat is, I'm putting it to its test here, but.
Okay, I'm gonna mute my mic and sort of lightly cough and make sure I'm ready to go. Okay, hang on.
It is he opens his mouth. He gave an utterance to a sound which shook the air of the car like the hoarse roar of a lion. And it is this, the sound he makes. R-R-R-R-R-R-H.
Okay. The ears were deafened. Okay, I'm going to get an ugly grin distorting my face.
Yep, the lion is hoarse as well, so maybe it wouldn't work if I did it.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah, okay. How far can you back up from your microphone? Okay.
Oh, that probably wasn't very wise.
Oh, no.
That's like your Nolte impression.
Yeah, we still have a few minutes of podcast here to do. Woo! Come on, man.
All right.
It was not articulate to our ears and not to be represented by any combination of letters.
Weird.
You just did. But and then the Dublin professor, I don't do an Irish accent, but he says, "Faith," exclaimed the Dublin University professor. "If that's what they call themselves, how shall we ever translate their names when we come to write the history of the conquest?" Like, you are 6 million miles away from that asteroid. What makes you think you're ever going to write a history of anything?
Yeah, really. They've dispatched you so quickly and with pretty, quickly, comparatively. So, I'd be worried about what I'm going to say in my farewell letter to my wife if she ever recovers the ashes of our ship.
I'm going to give you one more sonic challenge.
Okay.
And this won't require you to, your voice is fine as it is. I will read it in a flat tone, and then you will have to do it as it is to be read.
Okay.
Whist, God, mon. Yeah. I'll start again. "Whist, mon," replied a professor from the University of Aberdeen. "Let us whip the gill-ravaging villains first, and then we can describe then by any intuilation that may suit our disposition."
So this is the second Scottish guy that just has spoken out of the blue here?
It is. We have an Irish and a Scottish, so I assume that's supposed to be funny, those two standing next to each other. I don't know.
All right. Well, this is the sort of thing, don't know if I've ever attempted this out loud, but we'll see.
"Whist, mon! Let us whip the gill-ravaging villains first, and then we can describe them by any intuition that may suit our disposition."
That was like Robert Burns.
Sure, yeah. Where's my McDuff roll? Come on.
Lay on, McDuff. Oh, that was good. All right. So, yeah, they're assuming that they're going to get this done, but it's not going to be easy because he just roared like a horse lion.
Yeah.
Saying his name.
And yeah, so they're freaked out. And I was wondering, they don't really describe what they're doing or anything, but they talk about, this happens. Their efforts to learn the language were renewed and repeated every few hours. And it's like, someone's got to be prodding him with some sort of shocking device at some point in time, just to...
I think a cane back chair with no bottom to it is implied here.
Yeah, right? I mean, they hate these guys. They think they're pure evil. Like, this guy's the one they have contact with after so many millions of Earthlings died. And there's got to be a little bit of twisting going on, a little bit of torture.
Maybe a wet rag over the face and then a bottle of water poured on that and repeating a question over and over again.
"What is your name? What do you call yourself?" I've told you so many times. But he says, finally, one day the prisoner, who seemed to be in an unusually cheerful frame of mind, because we hadn't blared the Slayer into his cell at 1 a.m. that morning, indicated that he carried in his breast some object he wished us to see. And it says, the Martian's book. With our assistance, he pulled out a book. So he just had a book on him the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he was just...
Tom, did you frisk the Martian?
You know what?
I didn't know what the word frisk meant.
there is an example, an illustration of this happening. And it's the first time we see a Martian without his little hood and hat on. And he looks like a founding father bobblehead.
Yeah,
you know?
Ben Franklin,
Martin Van Buren type of guy.
Yeah, the eyes are a little less bulgy than I remember. Mm-hmm. But I guess this is him cheerful, so maybe the eyes unbulge.
Right, yeah. He does. His eyes are open, though, both of them. So I'm
yeah, the Australian is Australian. It's a good way to talk, yeah. That's the way to do it, man. His legs look a little weird here. But he is huge. Like, the guy's standing, he's seated in this drawing. Oh, also his hands are weird. I forgot to note.
Oh, yeah.
That.
It looks like
he's three fingers. He has like a little flipper and then a couple fingers. But the knee pads, what are those for? What do you think they're doing there?
Service.
Or is it an external patella? Who knows?
That's true. In the other illustration, I was confused about that as well. But that could be part of their physique.
Yeah. But anyway, so his good nature had manifestly been growing day after day. So I don't know, an unnamed guy should have yelled that, like, his good nature is growing. Manifestly so, sir. Like, damn it.
Damn. Manifest guy.
It's him again.
It's so obvious he's trying to get a catchphrase going. Make it so.
Yeah, so they learn his language through his book, which looks like, Chinese or something they say.
That's what they say, yep.
Looks like characters. But again, like you said, How do you look? Like, let's get down to the nitty gritty here. And I feel like service does this a lot. Like, don't worry your pretty little head about it. The experts have this covered. They'll learn the language. You don't need to know. You don't need to see the sausage being made.
Right.
We'll learn his language.
Yeah, that's why we brought these linguists who I just mentioned when we had the need for linguists to be aboard the ship.
Right. Electricians, we need a light to read this book, but oh shit, they're all dead.
Oh man, we needed them to recharge the nad shocking rod too, and that's yeah, because it says that the predator had been unwilling to aid them. Of course, it would have been impossible to proceed, but fortunately for us, he seemed more and more to enter into the spirit of the undertaking and actually to enjoy it himself. I was just having a blast being imprisoned on this thing. And they also hand-waved away. He doesn't need the pills anymore because there's plenty of the oxygen and the nitrogen on board our ship for him to breathe anyway. Like, the atmosphere is just fine.
It's kind of like, the lion enjoys doing his routines like this, whoosh, whoosh. He's really got a good personality.
Right. Yeah. So is he accurately describing this, or is the Martian just sort of reeling everybody in to gain the trust before, betraying all the humans? Who's to say?
Yeah. Well, what I assumed when he pulled out the book was it was a cookbook for man. But who knows?
Yeah.
Well, so they learn the language. Oh, okay. We didn't read through the prisoner teaches.
Yeah. No, that's where I stopped.
Okay. All right. But, I stopped there too.
Great. Well, that is this section. It is... we criticize the pace, but they've gone into space twice now and have a Martian aboard their ship, and many people have died and many Martians have died. So, what more do you want from a space epic like that?
Yes, I think I pitched a movie and I had a similar thing where it wasn't, people returning to Earth twice, but a person went, you get rid of that repeated beat. And I think that was the first time I'd ever heard that term, repeated beat. But boy, returning to Earth is the biggest repeated beat. service, you got to get rid of that second trip back down to Earth and launching all over again.
Were you chapfallen when the executive told you that?
I was Gilcrestin? Nowhere. What is the word? I was Gilravaged, I got to say. By the titulation? What was it? Intitulation. Gilravaging villains.
Wow.
All right.
All right.
Well, I'm riding high on my 5 for 5, so...
As you should be. I think it's going to be very interesting to see where it goes. We have 2 more episodes of this. This is the halfway mark of the book, so what diabolical tricks our fan fiction writers will have for you in the final segment. But I don't think we have any more time for emails, but let's do some dumb sentences before we quit this.
A sentence begins with a capital letter. A capital letter is a letter that's big. A capital letter is not a small letter. A capital letter is big, big, big.
So yeah, again, these are dumb sentences submitted by our loyal Patreon listeners, patreon.com/372pages. Check it out. We covered a lot of these. A lot of these got hit, but we did have one that might break the record for the most submitted sentence. I forget what currently holds that, but we had one that I think like 5 different people submitted. We had the one about the gorilla in the wild from Ross. We had Balaji submitted, or which was perhaps most probable, there might be practically no difference in the effective range of the engines. We covered that one as well. Mm-hmm. Hayden submitted the in our eyes, the moral character shown through their physical aspect and rendered them more terrible. He compared that to Anakin Skywalker's classic line, "From my point of view, the Jedi are evil."
Yes.
This is the one, 4 different people, Jenny, Heather, Craig, and Daniel submitted, as we spent quite a bit of time on, "This must be the great gold mine of Mars," said the president of an Australian mining company, opening both his eyes and his mouth as he spoke.
Okay.
Curtis and Janelle both submitted, "Gold is a thing which might make his appearance anywhere and at any time without offering any excuses or explanations." Jeffrey submitted the lengthy one that I kicked it off with, the run-on sentence that I had to take a deep breath in describing their sleeping quarters. Harris submitted the "it was an inauspicious beginning for us," which is, you know, a huge understatement returning back to Earth. Justin submitted, "it is an asteroid," said somebody. That's, as we now know, it's either Moon Jules or Tom, or maybe they're the same person. Claire submitted the many entertainments provided while we were away. Mike submitted... "That fixes them," said Mr. Edison, turning to me with a smile. He points out that Mr. Edison has said this in the vacuum of outer space, and a page earlier it was pointed out that they couldn't hear the gun fire in a vacuum. Another page before that it was noted you can't hear the cheering in space, so it's unlikely that he heard Mr. Edison. Edmund submitted, there was another page of the book where he described the Martian using his fingers to sign as people do on Earth, and I looked it up and saw ASL was invented in like 1817, so it was very odd that he did not use the term sign language in that.
Oh yeah, I wondered about that too. I forgot that. Yeah.
Edmund submitted, "its intrepid commander felt that his post should be that of the greatest danger and where the severest blows would be given and received." Spicy. And Andrew submitted the old superstition that we say every day about Earth. "Yes, surely this is a flying hell." Both of mine got burned. I think I had the gold may appear anywhere, and then my other one was that long run-on about sleeping quarters from the beginning.
I guess I'll just repeat this one. "Faye, have you got one of them men from Mars?" just in its context of people going like, "Hey, how'd we do? Did Earth win?" And then groundskeeper Willie shows up to say that.
And that was probably at the height of, you know, like no Irish need apply type of thing. Like, get that guy.
Yes.
Oh. All right. Well, lots of fun, everybody. Thank you for submitting all your fanfic and sentences. And thank you for reading along with us. And thank you for everyone on Patreon. This is a very fun one to do. I'll try to remember to post those illustrations.
Oh, those are so great. Yeah, thanks, everyone. This is, I'm glad we get one that I think everyone can enjoy. You should read along in this one. It's easy.
Yeah.
Just do it and have fun.
Yeah, and the next assignment, I have it right here. It is, we're going to read through, there's a part in chapter 13 that says, "a tedious language lesson." So we'll stop right there, because that will live a little sizzle for the next, the final chapter will be, what is this tedious lesson we're about to be imparted on?
Oh, I'm not chapfallen at all by that. All right.
Thanks,
everyone.